Thank you for standing by. The conference is now being recorded. You may begin.
Okay, thank you very much, and welcome to the March 2011 Charm Telecon. I had to check the date. Our speaker today is Dr. Randy Kirk. He is a member of the Cassini Radar Science Team, and he's from the Astrogeology Science Center of the USGS, Geological Survey, in Flagstaff, Arizona. Nice place to live. He got his PhD in planetary sciences from Caltech some years ago. His particular interest is in geologic processes on Saturn's moon Titan, and that's what he's going to describe today. He's going to describe the kind of science that can be done with the radar instrument, and in particular, weigh in on the interesting debate over whether Titan is geologically active. The title of his talk is Exploring Titan in 3D with Cassini Radar, Including Evidence for and Against Ice Volcanism. So, welcome, Randy.
Thank you very much. And as we will see as I get into the talk, that means for and against in different places. I'm going to give some background. If we go to the outline slide, second slide, I'll give a brief introduction to Cassini-Huygens, because I suspect that many of you are regulars that have attended more of these talks and know all about it. The radar instrument that I'm involved with and Titan, the techniques of radar grammetry, which sounds rather fearsome, but I will explain them hopefully in a simple way, and then looking at different things that we've discovered on Titan's surface, some of which we thought were perhaps volcanoes and later concluded that they probably aren't. And then from this fall, some exciting work where we think we have a really good case for a volcano in one place. And in case you're wondering about the dragon, he's the guardian of the Garden of the Hesperides. I was lucky enough to give a talk at a meeting in Barcelona last year. This dragon guards the golden apples of the sun, and I've photoshopped that to suggest that he may be our guardian on Titan as well. Next slide. Cassini-Huygens, I won't say a whole lot about this because I think it's pretty well known. You can see in the picture that the Cassini orbiter releasing the Huygens probe, which of course landed on Titan in 2005. Cassini has been orbiting Saturn and flying by Titan ever since. And it has a lot of instruments on it, as you can see, one of which is the radar, which uses 2-centimeter microwaves to image the surface of Titan. And the reason it does that is that Titan has a very dense and very smoggy atmosphere, and to the human eye, you wouldn't actually see the surface through the clouds. In the near infrared, you can see the surface at a number of different wavelengths, but the highest resolution mapping of the surface comes with our radar imager, both making what are called SAR, or synthetic aperture radar images, with a fairly high resolution of hundreds of meters, and then gathering more global information about topography and properties at tens to hundreds of kilometers of resolution. And we're excited to do this because Titan is just about the most interesting place in the solar system. It's the second biggest of the natural satellites, has a dense atmosphere, mostly nitrogen, but a lot of organic compounds at a very low temperature. A large amount of organic chemistry stimulated by sunlight and by the materials that are available there. And the net result is that Titan has a range of geologic processes that are similar to those on Earth, but involving different materials. So water is at minus 180 C, of course, a rock, and if it gets hot enough, it might erupt as an ice volcano. The role of water on Earth is played by methane, on Titan, and it actually has a hydrologic cycle of evaporating and raining out and running across the surface, and there are lakes and seas, as we'll see in a few minutes. Next slide is an overview of how the radar gets data from Titan. We're orbiting Saturn, but from the point of view of Titan, we're a flyby instrument, and so we do different things when we're at different distances. And this is sort of schematic of the typical radar pass. Sometimes radar doesn't do anything, and the other instruments take the lead. But when we do operate, we use the main beam and kind of scan a low-resolution image at great distances. somewhat higher resolution scans of the surface as we get closer in. Then a little bit of altimetry where we're looking straight down and we get a topographic profile. And then just in the few minutes around closest approach, we look off to either the right or the left, and we use five beams that are available to us in the radar, and we build up an image strip. And the term SAR, synthetic aperture, basically has to do with the fact that we use magic, to, for want of a better term, to see things that are much smaller than those beams. So we're actually resolving what's inside our image strip with hundreds of pixels across it. Next slide. So I will just show a few of the global products first to give you some background. The global radiometry slide comes in with a map of the temperature of Titan, or what's called brightness temperature. Actually, Titan has such a dense atmosphere that it's all at almost the same physical temperature. So what you're seeing is the brighter areas are material that emits radiation a little better, and the darker areas are materials that don't emit so well. And if we click and bring in the optical image in the near infrared, you can see there's a good deal of similarity there. I've actually inverted that image so that the dark sand dunes around the equator show brighter, and they correspond to the more emissive areas. Xanadu, which is physically very bright, emits less thermal radiation, so it's dark. And this radiometry also tells us something about physical properties. In the next click, you see dielectric constant, which is pretty uniform. And then the final map on this slide is something called volume scattering, which is to do with how much of the signal from our radar comes from below the surface rather than the surface itself. And you can see there's a real strong signature of that in Xanadu, which is kind of a unique region on Titan. In the next slide, we have the imaging results. Now, the scatterometry is a kind of imaging at low resolution of how strongly the radar waves are reflected. But then we have this synthetic aperture stuff in blue with resolutions of hundreds of meters. And then there's an intermediate case, which I've shown in brown, which is high altitude SAR, which is a little bit coarser, a few kilometers resolution. So the point of this slide is that there's a lot of different pieces, and we've covered something over half of Titan with the scatterometry. We've covered a little bit less than half of Titan so far with the SAR. And finally, if you click again, you'll see a little arrow come in. And unlike the previous slide, where everything we know can be summarized in one PowerPoint, if you really were to zoom in, the little red rectangle shows about one screenful at full resolution. So I could spend the next 45 minutes just going through this image mosaic and showing you the interesting stuff that's in there. Rather than doing that, I'm going to go to the next slide and just show a few examples. I have two slides of this. So what do we find when we look at Titan's surface in high resolution? Well, we find impact craters, but surprisingly few of them. There are about a half a dozen well-preserved craters that it's completely obvious that that's what they are and not something else, and I've shown two of them at the upper left here. And then there's a lot of things that look like either degraded craters or else things that are just so circular that it's hard to imagine what else they might be, and I've shown one of those. It's probably a ring of a crater rim poking up through other materials in the top center. We find isolated mountains, chains of mountains, as seen in the upper right, and the way we know they're mountains, the illumination comes from the top in this image, and we see the bright and the dark sides of them. And Xanadu, in particular, is basically wall-to-wall mountains. Most of the equatorial zone, aside from Xanadu, is covered with dunes. As you see in the lower left there, the long, skinny, dark things are sand dunes aligned with the prevailing winds at the season when they're strongest. And the brighter stuff is bare ground without sand on it that pokes up locally and diverts the dunes. And that's mainly around the equator. At mid-latitudes, we see plains that are kind of boring, and they range from completely featureless, and you see some of that in this image, too blobby, and we don't really know what accounts for the different bright and dark blobs. In the next slide, some more interesting features. On the plains, there are things that look like flows, and they might be lava, some of them. Others might be sedimentary. I think this one probably is in that category. Things that are definitely evidence of a precipitation and sediment cycle, we see channels in many areas of Titan. Sometimes they're just bright material on the surface, which in radar generally means that it's a rougher surface than the surroundings. Sometimes they're cut into the terrain and they may be darker, which would tend to indicate smooth sediments. And sometimes these channels are so abundant that it comes together in what we call chaos terrain that appears to have been heavily eroded. And then if you follow in the northern and southern polar areas of Titan, follow these channels far enough, you'll eventually find them coalescing into a combination of small lakes and large, very large lakes that really qualify as seas. The image on the right there, we don't have the scale, but the biggest lake there is larger than any of Earth's great lakes, and this is on a body that's a third the size of the Earth. So these are substantial liquid bodies. We know from a number of lines of argument they're liquid. They look extremely dark to the radar because they're so smooth that they just reflect the radar energy off in the opposite direction, and very little of it comes back to our instrument. We've also seen with the infrared instruments on Cassini reflections, a glints of sunlight off the surface of these bodies, so it's pretty clear that they are smooth bodies of liquid hydrocarbon at the low temperature environment of Titan. And you can see how much like Earth this looks, with areas that have, valleys have been eroded and have a branching pattern like river channels on Earth, and then kind of drowned valleys around the edges of the lakes that are like the Chesapeake Bay and so on Earth. Okay, the next slide. I'm going to start talking about topography, which is sort of my contribution to this, but maybe this is a good point to pause and ask if there are questions.
Randy,
yes.
I'm sorry to ask this question, but I'm having a really hard time hearing. Every once in a while you get a few words that come up that I can hear, but it's really low.
Is anyone else having that problem? I'm hearing quite well.
I'm okay. Jason, New York.
Not on my regular phone, so that's probably it.
Yeah, I'm not having a problem.
Well, I can certainly lift the handset. I'm doing this with my speakerphone.
No, that's okay.
If it'll help, I will. Of course, with the handset, there's always the danger that my attention will flag and I'll not hold it properly. So,
no.
Yeah,
no,
you're clear
okay.
And you're dirty.
I'll make do.
Okay, well, I will do my best to project as well as I can.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Randy at this point?
Yes, the last slide, the polar seas. How close to the poles are these seas?
They tend to be from about 75 degrees poleward, and in both the north and the south, it turns out the actual 90-degree point is probably dry land. But in the north, we see kind of a division between small lakes and little round pockets of liquid on one side of the pole, and then these giant seas on the other. In the south, we see a much smaller number of liquid areas.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll get, among other things, a bit of a handle on why are these lakes and seas at the poles when we start to talk about topography. And what I do is the what I call radar grammetry, which in a shorter word is stereo mapping, which I will describe. But first let's talk about the other ways you might get topographic information about Titan. As I said, the instrument has an altimeter mode where we point the radar beam straight down, we measure the time it takes to get an echo back from the surface, and that gives us a profile of elevations on Titan. And you see one of these at the upper right there, where we see the surface of Titan is the sort of the top of the bright stuff as a function of distance. But it's a pretty short arc. It's only a few hundred kilometers. It's kind of low resolution. And often these don't overlap the images, so it's a little hard to tell what we're looking at. But what we're basically seeing is an extremely flat area on most of that profile, and then there's some hills or mountains on the right-hand side that rise up maybe 400 meters above the other stuff. So pretty darn flat. A technique I've worked on for many years is called shape from shading, which is using the brightness information in images to infer about topography. And you can do that with radar. It's sometimes called radar clinometry. And there's an example in the lower right where we've pulled a profile of one of these mountains and kind of tried to use the fact that the face towards the radar is brighter than the face that is hidden from it, to reconstruct a profile of the height. And when we did that in this particular case, it came out to about 1,000 meters taller than the surroundings. This is a nice technique. It works at the resolution of the images, but it gets totally screwed up if you have brighter and darker materials because you're interpreting bright and dark as slopes. So unless stuff's uniform, it doesn't really apply. Some of our engineers on the radar team, after we got to Titan, discovered that they could do this thing they call SAR topo, which has to do with comparing the five beams of the SAR image and how they're deflected by the topography, and actually get a long profile or several profiles down the length of each one of our images. And that's really valuable. It's probably 10 times as much data as the altimetry. It's a similar resolution, and it's always located in an image so you can see what you're getting the topography of. Where we compare it agrees really nicely with the altimetry, which is probably the most rock-solid of the different methods. And it was a surprise that even when we go over major features, like Xanadu is the only one I've talked about so far, but I'll talk about the others in a minute. You see something in the image, and there's only a few hundred meters and no real clear pattern to what's going on. So it's rather frustrating to have these isolated profiles and not understand what they're telling us, and that's one of the goals for the stereo mapping. Actually gives you a two-dimensional picture of the topography. In a few rare cases, we can also do this with the shape from shading or radar clinometry. I noticed if you click this slide again, it brings in a quote from my colleague Ralph Lorenz, Titan is flat except where it isn't. And that is really true. There's at most 1,000 meters plus and minus of relief in most places, often only a few hundred meters. But there are some mountains. There are dunes. The next slide shows an area where the dunes are uniform enough that we applied the shape from shading technique to get a topographic map on the left. Profile through that shows that the dunes are about 100 to 150 meters high and a couple kilometers apart. And that's very similar to dunes in some of the great deserts on Earth. And I just put together a little visualization on the right where the actual relief is pretty subtle. So in the lower panels, I've exaggerated it, and you see these parallel dune features look a lot like those in Australia, in Africa, and so on. But this is really a rare data set where we can do the radar clinometry and get a map like this. Most areas on Titan are just too covered with bright and dark materials. So the global topography from altimetry and SAR topo is in the next slide. This is the image mosaic with these profiles on it, and what you'll notice is a couple of things. One is the total range is only about 2.5 kilometers. That's about 1/1,000th of Titan's radius. And in general, the equatorial areas are higher, and the polar areas seem to be lower in the blue tones, and the big seas in the poles are the lowest areas of all, which is pretty logical. Now, we don't know why those areas are lower, but it does make sense that the liquid goes there and fills those depressions. I could talk about this for a while longer, but there really is a surprisingly lack of a clear pattern as to high and low areas generally. So the next step is to try and use the radar grammetry to get in and make topographic maps of specific features so we can really see what they are. So, radar grammetry in the next slide has nothing to do with grandmas sitting in trees, no matter who they root for. When I talk to my professional colleagues, I say, radar grammetry is just like photogrammetry, only using radar images, and there's probably one or two people that clears everything up for, and you don't have to say anything more. But I will actually try to explain this in simple terms. Let's go to the next slide. Photogrammetry is the science of making measurements of things from images, in particular topographic measurements, geometric measurements from images, from photographs. Radar grammetry is the same thing, but starting with a radar image, and basically you just have to take account of the way imaging radar works. And the cartoon at the upper right is an attempt to illustrate this, that where a camera looks at the surface through a lens and forms an image of what's in front of it, the imaging radar sends out a pulse, receives an echo, and measures two things, basically the time delay, which gives you the distance. So a particular time delay would say that the feature you're looking at is on this blue sphere of a fixed distance from the Cassini spacecraft. And the other is actually the Doppler shift, in that things that are in front of the radar and coming towards it are going to be blue-shifted, things that are going away behind are red-shifted, and so we can actually tell front to back where something is by the frequency, and that's the magic that lets us see features that are smaller than the size of the radar beam. So we do this with one burst of energy from the spacecraft, and then the spacecraft flies on a little bit further along its flight, does it again, and we build up a strip image. And basically, so one coordinate is along track, the other is distance outward, and the cartoon at bottom right shows that different heights on a mountain can have the same distance from the spacecraft if their horizontal position is different. So that's a good and a bad thing. What it means is a single image is kind of ambiguous. It has height parallax in it, and you don't really know where things are. But it also means that if you have two images, you can solve for both the height and the horizontal position, just like a stereo pair of camera images. The final point is that radar provides its own illumination, and so there's a kind of a challenge or a paradox there that if you had two identical images, there wouldn't be any stereo. If you move the spacecraft position so it's very different, say on opposite sides of the mountain, you have really strong information about the geometry, but it becomes really hard to look at the images. If the dark side illuminated side, I'm sorry, the bright illuminated side in one image is the dark shadowed side in the other and vice versa, then they look so different that it just gives you a headache. So we have to kind of balance those two desires to have a different geometry but the same illumination. It's not perfectly possible. This might be a good place to stop and ask if there are questions about the method. Okay, I'm not hearing any, so let's get on from the generalities to the particulars of Titan. The next slide shows the equipment we use to do this topo mapping. This is one of my colleagues, Annie Howington Krause, and we use a commercial mapping system that's used for air photos, satellite photos, sometimes for military radars of the Earth, and we've adapted it to work on a whole bunch of different planets, including Mars and Titan and the Moon and so on. And the next slide kind of shows why we went this route with commercial software. It provides us a huge number of tools. In particular, that special display and stereo glasses lets us see the images in 3D. It lets us see our topo maps in 3D. We have tools to align the images, what we call controlling them, so they agree with the other map products of Titan. We collect a topographic model, DTM, digital topographic model, automatically by having the computer compare a pair of images. It doesn't do a perfect job, though, so we bring up the results on the stereo display and we can fix or improve that ourselves. And we can also collect specific data about features. the main problem is that this thing that you buy doesn't know anything about Cassini radar. And so we have to bring the data in, bring the images into it in a form that the package recognizes, and we actually have to teach it the geometry of a radar image so that it can do its 3D calculations, and that's called a sensor model, and we've actually done that. And then we have to get the data back out, and we use our own software package called ISIS for a lot of our work, so we export the results in that format to do other things with them. So this has actually proven very powerful for not just Cassini, but many missions. The next slide shows the amount of stereo coverage we have now. And, of course, we've through the prime mission of Cassini, the first extended mission, we're in a second mission extension that will go on until 2017. And the maps show the northern and southern hemispheres of Titan with more than 30 radar image swaths that we've obtained, and then I've colorized them where they overlap. Green, where the illumination is pretty similar from the same direction. Red, where it's opposite, which can be a little harder to work with, but is strong stereo, like I said. And yellow, where things cross more or less at right angles, which is kind of an intermediate case. And you can see we have, according to the list of overlaps that I've been tabulating over the years, we have more than 100 stereo pairs, and we've made something like 21 DTMs out of that so far. So we have lots more we can do, but we've learned a lot from the 21 overlaps that we've worked with so far. Going to the next slide, here's the very first one we chose to work with. These are two images of the Northern Seas. And I've colorized them with basically the angle at which the radar is looking at each point on the surface. And because that's different in the two images, that gives us stereo by combining these two. And obviously it's a really interesting area because it's rugged and eroded and it has rivers and it has seas in it. We want to know quantitatively just how steep it is and how high the mountains are and by inference how deep the seas are. So we analyzed that, and in the next slide you see a topographic overlay on the image. And once again, as with our other data sets I talked about before, the range is pretty small. It's a little over 1,000 meters. It's 1,200 meters or so from the tops of the highest mountains in this area to the shorelines. And we were very gratified to find that the liquid is in filling in the low areas. If it had come out that these dark things were on tops of hills, we would have had to come up with a totally different theory that involved something other than liquid. If we click again, you can see that island. We have the relief of that. It has a lot of lumpy features in the interior and rather steep shorelines. And a profile, when you click again, shows that what we get from the stereo agrees very nicely with the radar clinometry, the shape from shading in that area. Gives us basically confidence that both methods are producing sensible results. And finally, if we click again, there's a slope map that shows the slopes over distances of 5 kilometers or so are really pretty gentle. An awful lot of it is down less than a degree. The steep slopes on the island are a few degrees, and there's a final click will give you a slope histogram that shows that the most common slope on that island is around 2 degrees. So that's
what
really...
What slide number are you on?
I'm afraid I do not have slide numbers here, but it says first DTM, Kraken and Ligia Maria.
I think it's 18.
I will have to see. If
that's
I
okay.
go to slide, it is 18, yes.
Yeah, if you get out of the presentation mode, you can see the number. So it's 18.
And I'm just about to go on from that slide and show you a 3D visualization of one of the inlets of Titan Seas. And this is a little bit fanciful in the next slide. The topography of the land comes from our stereo mapping. I've filled in the liquid areas with just a ripply surface and a nice orangey atmosphere, which is more or less what Titan looks like. And the image is actually vertically exaggerated by a factor of 10, and it still looks pretty flat. So the bottom line is that the most dramatic areas on Titan, where we have mountains and islands and seas, are still pretty smooth by earthly standards. But if you were to go there, the atmospherics more than make up for the subtleness of the topography. And I put in a little quote from the national poet of Catalonia talking about the beauties of the sunset in the Garden of the Hesperides. I don't speak Catalan, but I can decode part of this, and that's what it's saying, is the sunset and the red colors of the sky and so on in the Garden of the Hesperides. So it seemed appropriate to talk about that when I was in Barcelona last year. Okay, let's move on to other areas. And before we do that, the next slide says effective unexpected Titan spin. Because Titan's surface wasn't visible until we had the radar to look through the atmosphere, we had to guess the orientation of its spin axis. And we made, if you click and bring in a map on the left, this is the North Polar area. You see the seas and lakes. And it looks pretty good. But if you zoom in to the area that is outlined by a square and click again and bring up a magnified version, there are some problems. And a final click here really outlines the problem. If you look closely, there's the same peninsula on the edge of one of these seas, and it's in two places at once in the different images. And this is because we had the wrong idea of how Titan rotates. So we had to take a couple years to model that, reprocess the images, line everything up. And when we did that, in the next slide, we were able to bring together all of those images of the North Polar area. On the left is just a map that shows how the images go from the pole actually down past the equator in one area. The little red and blue symbols are tie points that we use to connect them all into a properly consistent map. And then that got us the topographic map that you see on the right. And we see the seas in a little bit better coverage than before. The land areas above and below them are higher and are devoid of liquid. And the area of small seas over on the other side turns out to be higher standing than the deep seas. And so what we get are kind of pockets of small lakes in the highlands of the pole, and then big seas at the very lowest areas on Titan. We took this data set also and merged it with the global shape information. And in the next slide, this shows a data set that was used at JPL to make what they call a tactile map of the North Pole of Titan, so something that would actually be cast in plastic and people could run their fingers over it to get an idea of the scale of the topography of Titan. We just wish we had more stereo coverage. Unfortunately, we don't. The next slide, which I will do a check on, is number 23, shows Ontario Locus in the southern hemisphere. And this is the first lake that was really suspected on Titan. It was seen with the infrared cameras and then eventually imaged with the radar. And it's the biggest lake in the southern hemisphere, but quite a bit smaller than the ones in the north. And we waited patiently to see it with the radar and the two image strips here, and then a year or so later we got a second image covering it and were able to make a stereo map. So the next slide, Ontario DTM, shows first click those combined images. Here I have it with south at the top just for convenience, and bright areas around the lake. Obviously, the radar doesn't produce a color image, so in these lake images, I've just colored the darkest things blue and the brighter things that are probably land brownish to help distinguish them. The next click is the topographic model, which shows once again a little bit more than 1,000 meters from the shore of the lake to the highest areas surrounding. And those high areas are the rugged-looking radar-bright stuff. So we've got kind of crinkled, bright, high-standing mountains and darker, more featureless plains. And if you look north of the lake, of course, you see a even a river channel entering the lake there. And the final slide is a slope map, and again shows that as in the north, the mountains are kind of rugged and have slopes up to 10 degrees in a few places. The slopes around the lake are very small, less than a degree. Going to the next slide, this has to do with research that some of my colleagues have done, in particular Alex Hayes at Caltech, to find out how deep are these lakes. Well, we can't really measure that with the stereo. What he was able to show was that you can see a little bit of a ways into the lake near the shore, and it's brighter near the shore and fades out, and from that he could infer slopes. And when we compare, as seen when you click next, plots of RDTM with the slopes that he inferred from the fading away of the lake bottom in red, it's really excellent agreement. And so the suggestion then is if you continue these slopes out into the middle of the lake, it is for the most part less than 100 meters deep and quite shallow. And the shallowest area is kind of the heel of the foot that's labeled J in the little map. And actually, Cassini has seen the shoreline retreat in this area over a period of a couple years. And it suggests that we're losing about a meter of the liquid in the lake every year by evaporation. Okay, so the next slide shows a flyover of the lake, and you need to click on the video to start it. There's narration by our team leader, Steve Wall. It basically shows the location of the lakes in the north at first, and then we're going to zoom in on the lake to the south and fly around it. So as you see, Ontario is the biggest of the southern lakes, and we drop down and start to fly around it. And again, this is exaggerated by about a factor of 10, which makes these mountains look rather rugged and dramatic, but the plains are still quite smooth. So we pan around the shore of the lake and see these gently sloping plains, features built out into the lake that we don't fully understand, but maybe could be related to volcanism impact or even past episodes of lakes entering the rivers entering the lake, as you see on the other side at the end of the movie here. Okay, so at least on my screen, that concluded the video. I'm going to go to the next slide and just talk about a few more of the types of features we've looked at before getting on to the final topic of volcanism. So I talked already about the sand seas near the equator. When we've mapped these with stereo, here's an example, and we find that the bright stuff that doesn't look like dunes is higher standing. The dunes fill in the lowest areas with these streaks of dark material. And the amount of relief that's needed to stop the dunes, to block them, is surprisingly small. From the purple to the kind of aqua color is only about 300 meters. And that is enough to prevent the dunes from getting into these brighter areas. The next slide shows another area of dunes and things blocking them, and I wouldn't bother showing a second example, except this is the location where the Huygens probe landed, and it actually landed between two of the brighter dune-free patches in a little valley that from the radar also is dune-free. The topo map that we made in the middle, Part C, is actually tilted, which is an error. When we took the tilt out, we're able to see that the two bright areas that Huygens saw north and south of its landing site in the little blow-up A, that's Huygens' data, they correspond to high points. So they're standing a few hundred meters above the valley where the landing occurred and above the dunes to the north. If we go to the next slide, that's a perspective view now with 20-fold exaggeration and looking from the east into the little valley where Huygens landed. And this is a combination of three different data sets, the radar and radar stereo for the shape, the Huygens images for the high resolution details, and then spectral data from the Cassini Orbiter VIMS instrument showing that the dunes off to the right are a different material and appear in this portrayal redder, whereas the landing area is dune-free and bluer. Okay, and if we click again, it brings up an inset. Our group was also able to do stereo analysis of the Huygens probe images, and this shows kind of from the same angle the shoreline of that bright area, that bright elevated area, that shows it has river channels rather deeply cut into it and very steep slopes in the channels, showing that that's eroding probably rather actively and the material is being washed downhill into the dark areas like the one where Huygens landed. Okay, next slide. This is the start of the final part of the talk about whether or not there are volcanoes on Titan, so maybe a good place to pause and ask for questions.
Ed Blank, Solar System Ambassador. If we're losing a meter a year in a 100-meter deep lake, are we just lucky to arrive then, or is there some idea that there might be some refilling process going on?
It is most likely that this just reflects the seasons on Titan. Titan basically is inclined to the sun almost the same amount as Saturn is, and has therefore seasons rather like Earth's, but on a cycle of one Saturn year, which is 30 Earth years. And so because it has been summertime in the southern hemisphere of Titan through most of the mission, and the sun is now just beginning to move to the North Pole, probably the southern lakes have been evaporating and the northern lakes have been filling up from precipitation over the last few years. And then that's going to probably change and reverse over the coming decade. There's a separate question of why are there many more lakes in the north than the south, and that is not thoroughly understood, but one possibility is that there are longer-term climate cycles, certainly on Earth, certainly on Mars, and probably on Titan as well, that could act to shift the bulk of the liquid from one hemisphere to the other.
Thank you.
I don't think that Ontario Locus, which might be 100 meters deep or even more in a few places, is likely to disappear completely, but we have seen evidence of smaller lakes in the south that looked to have liquid in them and then dried up completely. Okay, so moving on to cryovolcanoes, I'm going to have to click a number of times in this slide to bring up my bullet points one by one. But before I do, I'll say cryovolcanoes is just a fancy term for ice volcanoes, and try and give a definition. A volcano on Earth is a place where the main bulk materials of the Earth, which is to say rock, have melted and erupted on the surface. And on Mars, it's the same thing. Silicates melt and erupt, forming volcanoes like Olympus Mons. So if you had a world that was made mainly of ice, and the ice melted and erupted, that would be an ice volcano or a cryovolcano. So I guess that's my first bullet point. Yeah, I'd forgotten I added that to the slide since I last used it. A cryovolcano is melting of the bulk material of a moon that's made out of ices, low-temperature melting materials. So the big question is, do they exist? Because it's kind of a theoretical concept. You know, you put together the idea of a volcano, which we've seen, and the idea of an icy satellite, which we've seen, and you say, well, maybe there are ice volcanoes, but do they really occur? We'd like to know that. The cartoon at right, which I'm not going to go into in any detail, illustrates another kind of pressing reason scientists want to know about this on Titan. As I said, there's a lot of organic chemistry, and this is an illustration of both the physical cycle of evaporating methane and raining it out again, and chemical reactions that happen in the atmosphere that turn methane into ethane and ultimately into kind of tarry sludge that sits on the surface. and the other part of the chemistry is hydrogen, which escapes to space. So actually, in a relatively short time geologically, maybe no more than a billion years, sunlight would destroy all the methane that we see on Titan. And one way to resupply it is to have volcanoes erupting and bringing gas from the interior of Titan. That certainly happens on Earth. There's a lot of volatile gases that come out in volcanic eruptions. It might explain why we continue to see all of this methane on Titan after several billion years. But obviously that wouldn't work if there aren't any volcanoes, so we want to know if they exist. The next click, how do we find them? Well, there's a number of ways. We certainly look. Our radar, as I said, has a radiometer, which is measuring the temperature of Titan. And what it really sees so far is just tiny temperature differences that really are not, things are at the same physical temperature, but some areas emit a little better and look like they're a few degrees hotter, and others a few degrees colder. If there was an active volcano, we might see a 100-degree temperature spike, and we haven't seen that so far. We look, when we go back to an area, for changes, and there have been some suggestions of changes kind of in the brightness of different areas, but really that can be laid at the door of the way we're viewing the angle we're looking at things. There's nothing definitive. We haven't seen something that looks like a lava flow or a mountain appear on Titan. So that leaves us with the final method, which is morphology. In other words, looking at things and saying, gee, it looks like a volcano, based on analogy with other bodies that we know better. and the next bullet indicates there's problems with that. First of all, as I'll talk in the following slide, what do we look for? How do we know something is a volcano? And when we have limited resolution observations, and even the highest resolution images of Titan are pretty crummy compared to what we have for the Earth or Mars, how can we be sure? And so to check the interpretation, if we can get higher resolution imaging and look for detailed features on something to confirm whether it is or isn't a volcano, that's great. If the first sighting was at the limit of resolution, the other thing, which is where this talk is headed, is topography can tell you something more than just the images themselves. So let's go on. Okay, one more click on this slide. Some case studies showing both places where topography tended to indicate things weren't volcanoes, and then our new result from last fall, Sotra Facula, which we think all the signs point that it is a volcano, and the best case we have yet on Titan for that. Okay, so what would a cryovolcano look like? Well, it's worth noting that you say volcano, people think of a mountain with lava flows and maybe a crater in the top, but not all the volcanoes on Earth look like that. There's volcanoes so flat because the lava was so runny that you wouldn't even know you were standing on them. There are linear features at the mid-ocean ridges. With ice volcanoes, we don't know whether we might get liquid water eruption, which is very runny and might fill in a basin, like in the image in the upper left, which is Titan. That might be a liquid water volcanic fill of an impact crater. Other icy satellites, there are things that look almost like glaciers on Ariel, and kind of a hybrid between a glacier and a volcano on Ganymede that might be, instead of molten material, either partly molten or just high-temperature ice erupting. So these are all pictures of things that have been posited as volcanoes on other bodies, and they look rather different from one another. And the most amazing thing is we've actually seen active eruption on Enceladus at the right. The title that says that's Enceladus seems to have gone AWOL, but that's a view of gases erupting from Enceladus, and because Enceladus is made mostly of H2O and so is the plume, that is by definition a volcano. It's the bulk material of Enceladus getting hot enough to erupt onto the surface and, in fact, out into space. And when you look at the area it's coming from in that bottom right image, it's basically a crack in the ground. So almost nobody, a geologist, would look at that without the evidence of the eruption and say, oh, that's a linear crack in the ground. It must be a volcano. So it's really hard to hard to say what to look for, but some of the things might be evidence of material flowing out on the surface, construction of a mountain by the buildup of such material, and maybe evidence of the holes that the material came out of, and that's what we're going to look for. The next slide shows in the middle one of the early infrared images of Titan, and this is a feature that was informally called the snail for pretty obvious reasons, and the people that first saw it compared it to these lava flows, known lava flows on Venus and on the Earth, where very, very thick lava kind of piles up into a pattern of lobes or blobs, one upon another in a stacked way, and spreads rather slowly across the landscape. So this is a low-resolution image of something like 5 kilometers resolution of the snail, and you would hope if you got a better image of that, you could look for these patterns of kind of wrinkles on the surface of the feature that would really show it's a flow, the steep edge around the margin that shows that it was thick material that flowed and confirm that. So going to the next slide, here is a radar image of the Tortola, the snail, and for those of you doing this in PowerPoint, I've covered up the interesting information with the infrared image. So there's the snail, and if we click, we'll take away the infrared image and see the radar, and what we see is there's a bare patch in the field of dunes, but there's no structure in it. So it's just another of these little hills that stick up out of the dunes in the equatorial zone. There's no evidence of these sort of folds and festoons like you get on lava flows. There's no evidence of a steep edge. And if you click again and bring in that SAR topography profile, it's not really clear what's going on. It doesn't look like a very high area. Even the total range from lowest in purple to highest in red is only 300 meters, and this bare area doesn't look really much higher than the dunes around it, maybe 100 meters or so, but no more. So this is a case where the early idea that this was a volcano was kind of busted by additional data. But what do you do if you first see something and it's at the limit of resolution in radar, where there's no higher resolution images? In the next slide, we see a couple of areas from our very first radar image of Titan. Arafluctus on the top left kind of has all the same features. It's kind of an ink blot, to be honest. It's tantalizing to see what you're seeing, but it looks to me and many colleagues like the feature on Ganymede, where you have kind of an amphitheater opening up and then a long tongue of stuff flowing out of that. But it's going to be many, many years before we go back to Titan with a high-resolution camera and can get a better picture to see, does this thing have flow features on it? Is it lava? Rohe fluctus on the right, kind of the same thing. It looks like a little circular source area and a tongue of material, and that's bright on one side, dark on the other, which could mean that it's elevated about 200 or 300 meters, as shown in the profile. So that's convincing to some people that maybe this is an ice volcano, but we are not likely to have confirming data anytime soon. Winnia fluctus in the middle is a flow of something in the same radar image, but probably a rather thin flow, and we think most likely sediments rather than volcanic at this point. And certainly the SAR topography over it shows that it doesn't have any appreciable relief. So these are cases where, one case that we thought might be a volcano, Winnia, and two that we in the radar team still think might be, but you can't really convince anybody because this is all the information we have. So you look at the picture, you say it looks like a volcano, but that doesn't mean it is proven to be. Okay, now that was an ambiguous case. The next slide shows a case where we really thought we had something volcanic that didn't pan out. So the image, again, from our very first flyby of a feature that got named Ganesha, and the feature of relevance is at the left side here, there's kind of a big circular thing that's two-thirds complete, is cut off at the top end of the strip, and has kind of a bright spot in the center and radiating features. And this looked really familiar to those of us on the Cassini radar team who had been on the Magellan mission. If you click the slide, you'll see a Magellan image come in of what's called a steep-sided dome on Venus. And this has many of the same features we thought we saw at Ganesha and is known from altimetry to be a 1,000-meter thick dome and probably a volcanic construction, because there's few other ways you could build something that's sort of the dimensions of a gingersnap cookie with cracks in the top. It is logically a volcano. So what is the topography of Ganesha on Titan? Is it a dome? Well, if you click, the image comes in color, and you'll see that no, it certainly isn't a dome at the present day. Red is high, purple is low, and the so-called circular feature of Ganesha is broken up into a bunch of kind of lumpy high and low areas. The area off to the east is much lower, and these bright areas that sort of look like rivers and flows do fill in the bottom of the valleys. So it's probably a heavily eroded area. It's still possible that Ganesha started out as a dome a long time ago and has just been so badly eroded we can't recognize it. But it sure as heck was not confirmation that we had understood the feature correctly when we got this topo. If you click again, video will appear flying over again with exaggeration. Purple is low, red is high. You see these channels to the east of Ganesha, and in the background, a bunch of lumps, but not anything that looks like a cookie, that looks like a volcanic dome. It's high on the east, generally low on the west, and lumpy in between, and we're left not being able to say whether it started as a volcano and was broken up, or whether it's just sort of a coincidence that the eye sees a resemblance to Venus there, but it's not real. Okay, going to the next slide, this is a little bit better case that kind of convinced the people in the radar team, but not everybody else. In the equatorial parts of Titan, south of Xanadu is an area that in the infrared in the lower left shows up as kind of a bright semicircle, and the radar image at right shows that there are some mountains and some rivers and then an area of these bright and dark tongue-like features, lobate features, a geologist would call them, that are certainly consistent with what lava flows look like in radar images of the Earth. And if we click this and bring in the topographic model, we see the mountains in the lower right are the highest, and that the bright areas, there are bright planes that come in as purple that are the lowest, and the bright and dark lobate stuff stand up above that by a couple hundred meters. So it sort of clarifies that, yes, these are thick plateaus on a lower surface, and that is also consistent with a volcanic interpretation. If we click again, you get a profile through there, and you can see that the relief of the flows is a couple hundred meters with rather steep edges. So that's consistent with volcanism, but we don't see where the lavas came from. We don't see other features that would really confirm that's what it is. So some people think this might not be a volcano at all. It might be sediments related to the river channels or something like that. Certainly that it's not proven to everyone's satisfaction. Okay, so let's move on to the closing part of the talk. SOTRA, in the next slide, we see a globe of Titan showing where it is south of the equator. It's a feature within these dark sand seas that I talked about, and they are dark both in the radar, which is black and white here, and in the infrared, which is the backdrop in color. So about 2007, we got a radar strip going through this area, and our team noticed the feature that is seen at the bottom center there, a kind of roughly circular thing, which we nicknamed the Rose, with dunes around it, and to the north of it, again, some kind of tongue-like or lobed features that are of the kind of shape that you would get if you had lava flows. So we thought, aha, this could be a volcano. Now, the great thing, which is totally a coincidence, a stroke of luck, is that this feature falls right where two of our images taken a couple weeks apart overlap. So we were able to make a stereotopographic model of the feature. If we go to the next slide, this sort of compares the radar and the VIMS infrared data set. And they really complement each other nicely. The rose is very clear in radar, and the flows are outlined better by their color difference, their compositional difference in the infrared. But you can see that there are flow fronts or boundaries that are in the black and white radar image that are consistent with the edges of that bright area that you see in the VIMS. So this is, in a sense, the opposite case of the snail, Tortola, where it doesn't really look like anything too interesting in VIMS, but it looks unique in radar. And the question is, what is the topography? So going to the next slide, here is the image yet again, our topographic map, and then a combination of the two so you see how they line up. And what we have, once again, like at the Huygens landing site in the other example I showed, the dunes are generally in low areas. The brighter features that are dune-free stick up. And sure enough, the rose, the central quasi-circular part of Sotra, is elevated, actually, as it turns out, almost 1,500 meters above the surrounding dunes, which is a pretty high mountain for Titan, not the highest we've seen. And as you see that purple area, there's actually a hole in the ground next to the mountain, which was very unexpected. And then to the north, the flow-like areas are kind of a mixture of high and low. And in particular, there's a profile across the middle area there that shows that there are areas, again, close to 1,000 meters high, but with a depression in the middle. And I have to say, when I saw this topo map, I understood it supported that Sotra was a volcano and maybe that there was another one at the northern end of the pie slice, but I didn't really understand what was going on in the middle. It seemed like maybe this was a lava flow that had been broken up somehow. But when we go to the flyover, which is in the next slide, things become a little bit clearer. So let's go to, and this is a good point to stop and get a slide number check, slide 40, an Earth-like volcano revealed. And let's click on the video, and we'll start after the title card with an overhead view and tip down. This is radar data colorized with the VIMS infrared, and it's exaggerated about a factor of 10. And you see that mountain where the rose is, and you see a huge pit below the surface, which is unique in our experience of Titan. In the foreground, that high and low area is kind of stadium-like. And in seeing this for the first time, I realized, gee, that's probably another volcano with a crater in the center. On the front of Sotra, there's this sort of bitten-out area. It's a second depression that doesn't go below the surface. Changing the color to represent heights will fly over the flows, and what I'm claiming is another oval mountain with a depression in the middle of it, so a second volcano to north of Sotra. Then we fly over an area that's basically low and dune-covered, and fly up to the third mountainous area to the north, which has that same sort of bread crust texture as the top of the rose, and is associated with flows going off to the east that are well outside of the stereo area, unfortunately. So to recap, we've got a mountain with not just one, but maybe two bites taken out of it, flows associated with that, and then a string of other mountains that appear also volcanic, leading off to the north. If we go to the next slide, we'll see that there are many analogs of this on the Earth and other silicate bodies that are volcanic. And these are just examples of kind of the constellation of features that we see at Sotra that makes us think it's a volcano. These different volcanoes on Earth and Venus and Io formed in somewhat different ways, so they're not even identical to each other, but they show the features, like having a mountain with a crater partly bitten out of the side of it, having flows of lava associated with that. In the case of Laki in Iceland and SP Crater in Arizona, these are good examples where there's a fracture in the ground and you get not just one volcano, but several in the same area somewhat aligned along a common trend from north to south, and even that some of those individual volcanoes that formed along fractures can be kind of elongated, like the stadium-shaped feature that I was pointing out at Sotra that is secondary to the rose itself, but still turns out in 3D to be an important feature and probably another volcano. So let's go on. Next slide. One more thing. The area that's not in stereo north of Sotra is shown at the upper left here. That third peak is kind of at the top left of this scene, and you see that the single image shows bright and dark lobey stuff extending off to the east. And I just put this in to compare with part of Xanadu at the lower right. These are images at the same scale. And that area of Xanadu, which also shows this kind of pattern of bright and dark features that look like they might be flows and might have a kind of west to east spreading trend, had been previously described in a paper as a possible area of volcanism. So, again, we're back to the not definitive because we don't have the topography for these areas, but certainly suggestive idea that these are big areas of volcanism associated with the same processes that formed the mountain and the craters at Sotra. Going to the next slide, conclusions. On a couple of levels, first of all, I hope you got the sense that Titan is a very interesting place. It has as many geologic processes as Earth, with the exception that Earth's geology is shaped by biology. But it's got atmosphere, rivers, seas, probably volcanism, certainly wind-blown features like dunes. But the substances involved are alien to us. And what that means is it's a really, really great test case for planetary scientists to sharpen their skills by understanding what will be the same and what will be different when you make volcanoes out of ice and sand dunes out of frozen organic material and so on. Second lesson is that the topographic mapping really helps us go beyond just staring at the images and wondering whether things that look like Earth-like features really are. Not just volcanoes, but every feature on Titan and on other bodies you understand better in 3D. And doing the kind of flyover videos that I showed is especially helpful because it really helps the brain grasp what's going on. And that's something you can only do with topo maps, area coverage of topography, and not with the profile techniques that I talked about earlier in the talk. Finally, Sotra is our best candidate yet for a volcano on Titan, Titan's Mount Doom, if you will, because it really shows the classic familiar pattern of a mountain with a crater with flows associated with other things that are probably also volcanoes, where in other places we either saw something that looked like a volcano and it wasn't topographically appropriate for one, or where we see one of the features that might be volcanic or might be something else, like something flowed, but was it lava? And then, in conclusion, we've got a number of years of the mission left. We will take more images, get more stereo, but even if things stop this week, we have a backlog of these wonderful stereo images of Titan, and my group is continuing to explore and make 3D models of different features on Titan, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot more. And then I'll just leave the final slide up is an artwork from Lord of the Rings, but there's Mount Doom, and vertically exaggerated, as were all of my portrayals of Titan, but I think the sky is certainly evocative of what it would be like to be on Titan and see these volcanic features that we think we've discovered. So I'll stop there.
Fabulous presentation, Randy. Thank you very much.
I ran over horrendously, as usual. But
oh, well, that's okay. I don't think we have any hard and fast rules. Are there questions for Randy out there in the audience? What in the XXM, what can you identify particular observations that you're going to target? What are you particularly excited about?
I would say that the biggest thing, the reason for the second extended mission is to follow Titan and Saturn and everything in the Saturn system through as much of a seasonal cycle as we can, which will actually end up being about a half a Saturn year by the end of the mission. And so what we are charged with for Titan is looking for evidences of seasonal change. That would be going back and looking again mostly at the lakes and seas to look for the shifts in the distribution of liquid from one hemisphere to another and so on. We will certainly continue to look for changes that might be one of a kind, such as a volcanic eruption. And as a sort of secondary goal, we'll try and cover more and more of Titan and find out if there are other interesting things that we've missed.
So can you talk a little bit about the controversy over the cryovolcanism? Do other scientists, some don't agree, do they invoke other processes for these features? Can you just kind of describe?
Yes, happy to. It is definitely true that the topic of, well, the topic of cryovolcanism in the outer solar system has been somewhat controversial on other bodies too for many, many years, but certainly on Titan there are essentially two points of view. One is that we see evidence ranging from things that look reminiscent in the images of volcanoes on other bodies up to the case I tried to make where there's a cluster of features at Sotra that only occur together when you have volcanism. In other words, evidence that would make you think there is a volcano, there are theoretical reasons to think that there might be. And the other side of the controversy is that this is very much not proven, and that basically there have been many cases in the past where low-resolution data suggested something might be a volcano, and in many of them, when we got better data, the claims had to be retracted. And Ganesha on Titan is one example. A totally different one would be that there are large areas of Ganymede that are a satellite of Jupiter that are kind of bright and free of craters when seen at low resolution. And an early idea was maybe they were flooded by ice volcanism. And when Galileo got to the Jupiter system and took really high-resolution images, we discovered it wasn't flooding by ice lava. It was breaking up of the ground by tectonic processes, faulting, that was on such a small scale you couldn't see it from a distance, and that it had the same effect of erasing features. So it is possible to maintain the point of is basically a dead world with an atmosphere, and that what some people think is volcanism and material coming from the interior is just the result of erosion and more passive processes like that on the surface. Now, I think my colleagues on the radar team and I don't think that that is a completely persuasive line of argument when, for example, we see these flows at Hotai Arcus that are towering hundreds of meters above the rivers nearby. We think it's very improbable that they're simply areas of sediment deposited by those rivers. But the devil's in the details, and not everyone is convinced yet.
Fascinating. Science works, I guess. Are any questions for Randy in the audience?
I should probably know this. Which instrumentation tells us about the methane, and does it give us any aerial distribution information that might say that it's associated with one or more of these features before it diffuses out across the whole moon?
Yeah, there are a number of instruments that measure the composition of Titan's atmosphere, basically in the infrared, the near and far infrared, and by passing sunlight and starlight through the atmosphere and recording the signal. And they have sampled all around Titan. It's not like methane on Mars, where there's also a controversy there about whether there might be active volcanism or maybe even biologic processes releasing kind of methane in a few areas and at a few times and places, and that's parts per billion at most. And on Titan, methane is actually kind of in the atmosphere, much like water is on Earth. So it's not parts per billion, but it's not the main constituent. It's more like a percent of the atmosphere and pretty well mixed everywhere we've looked. So there's enough of it, and it's spread around well enough that it doesn't lead us back to potential source areas.
Ah, okay, that was what I was wondering. And have you been lucky enough to get stereo coverage of any of those impact craters to find out how tall they are?
No, so far we haven't. We actually hope to have a stereo image finally of one of the first and nicest ones that was imaged many years ago in the mission in the upcoming year, and so it'll be very interesting to try and measure the depth from that. Now, when we got the very first image of a crater on Titan, I actually did something sneaky, not that I can take credit for inventing it, but the idea is this: a crater is a very symmetrical feature, and if you have an image of it looking at it from the north, and you had an image looking from the south, the crater is the same either way. So why don't you just turn the view from the north around and compare it to the original view, and it's like you have a view from the south and you can do stereo. What that basically, another way to put that is you look at the near and far edges of the crater in the image, and if you assume that they are the same height in reality, you can look at how they're distorted in the image and estimate the depth of the crater. And we actually did that and found that the 80-kilometer across crater called Synlap was probably a little over a kilometer deep. So yet another case of things maxing out at sort of plus and minus 1,000 meters on Titan in terms of topography. But it'll be great to confirm that with an honest-to-goodness stereo pair.
And are you going to get that?
Yeah, we should actually get that, and I think it's in our next flyby, although I don't remember the exact date.
Any other questions for Randy?
Yeah, Randy, this is Mike Malaska, Solar System Ambassador and all-around fan of the Cassini mission.
Oh, I know Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hey. Hi, Marcia. How you doing?
Good. Good to hear from you.
So I had a question. So if this big, deep hole at SOTRA isn't necessarily a volcanic throat, as it were, what else could it be to have such a deep basin that's so small and sharp and right there in the center?
Well, that really is vexing to try and come up with an explanation. I mean, the known process that makes holes in planets is impact cratering. And if you see one hole, then you certainly can't rule out an impact origin. But as I said, there are very few impact craters that are really confirmed on Titan, and what we have here is what appear to be three depressions in the same area, two of them on the top of a mountain and one nearby, which is sort of oval rather than circular, and it just doesn't fit the pattern for an impact. But there aren't a whole lot of other processes that could create a localized hole in the ground. Dissolution of the terrain is one that might in some situations, but that's been posited to explain the sort of Swiss cheese pattern of a whole bunch of small circular depressions up near the poles, where many of those depressions get then little lakes of liquid in the bottom of them. And it's not a good fit to say that kind of process would create, you know, two or three really sharply defined, steep, deep holes and nothing else nearby, which is what we see at SOTRA. So I'm kind of out of ideas.
I have another question, if I can ask, too. Is You had mentioned earlier on that radiometry can show temperature differences in the materials. So would the fact that you're not seeing a temperature difference be able to constrain about how long it's been since any of these cryolavas have oozed up onto the surface?
Yes, it definitely would. We do not see any signature of something that is really so much brighter in the thermal emission that it actually physically has to be hotter than the rest of the surface. And the cooling times depend on the size of the feature, but they are, you know, on the order of a million years or something. So you could certainly have a situation where Titan is still as active as it ever was and has a volcano here and there at intervals of a million years, much as we have on Earth, and yet never catch one in the act of being erupting or hot. So the fact that, you know, if we found the appearance of something that looks like a new lava flow, that would be really strong evidence for active volcanism. If we found that and it was hot, it would be really, really strong evidence. But the fact that we don't see either changes during the mission or strong thermal emission, unfortunately, doesn't mean there's no volcanism.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot. Really nice presentation, too. Really, really liked it.
Thanks very much.
Any final questions for Randy? Well, I guess not. It really was fabulous, Randy. Thank you so much. It was a really good presentation.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Okay, so for participants, we'll talk to you next month. I don't have a speaker lined up quite yet, but I'm working on various things. So we'll talk to you at the end of April for the next Charm Telecon. Thanks again.